Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. With White House Speaker Boehner set to visit with Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel at the end of the month, we'll begin with the apparent strategy of the Republicans in collusion with Netanyahu to defund the Democrats by driving a wedge between donors and the Democratic base that could put Hillary Clinton in a bind as she tries to win over the Democratic base that is increasingly disillusioned with Israel at the expense of alienating big donors who make support for Israel a top priority. Peter Beinart, a professor of journalism and political science at the City University of New York, who is also a senior columnist for Haaretz and is the author of The Crisis of Zionism, joins us. Then we'll look into the civil war erupting in Yemen between forces of the ousted president and the Houthi tribesmen from the north who have captured most of the country. Dr. Sheila Carapico, a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond and author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia, joins us to discuss the rebel takeover of Yemen's third largest city, Taiz, and the claims by the so-called Islamic State that its affiliate was responsible for the suicide bombing at Zaidi Shiite mosques that killed 130 people. Then finally, we will speak with Roni Bar-Kan, who is an Israeli activist, conscientious objector, and co-founder of Boycott From Within, who is regularly shot at by his own army with rubber bullets and tear gas as he demonstrates with Palestinians against settlements and the occupation. We will discuss the clear rightward tilt of Israeli politics and Roni Bar-Kan's work with the Jewish ultra-Orthodox community in their struggle against ongoing attempts by the government to force conscription of the ultra-Orthodox into the Israeli army. Joining me now from the J Street conference in Washington, D.C., is Peter Beinart, who is a professor of journalism and political science at the City University of New York and a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. He's also a senior columnist for Haaretz and author of The Good Fight, The Icarus Syndrome, A History of American Hubris. And his latest book is The Crisis in Zionism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Beinart.
My pleasure.
And you're at the J Street Conference, and of course, J Street is the sort of liberal alternative to AIPAC. And what was your response to President Obama's interview in the Huffington Post, where he more or less is holding Prime Minister Netanyahu to his original election pledge that there would never be a Palestinian settlement on Netanyahu's watch? So what do you make of the president's apparent tactic there?
Well, I think that I think the president is right to do it. I mean, if you look at the history of Netanyahu's career and you also look at the way he's behaved since he became prime minister in 2009, there's really not much reason to believe that he's serious about creating anything near a viable Palestinian state. I think people in the Obama administration basically recognized that even before he made this statement. And now, by saying this, by not allowing Netanyahu to walk this back, first of all, Obama keeps a certain amount of pressure on him, maybe to try to do something more tangible, like a settlement freeze, something that would be at least some show of good faith towards keeping open the possibility of a two-state solution. But I think also Obama also leaves open the very real possibility of trying to go to the UN in some form and trying to promote the idea of a two-state solution there, which I think, especially with this Israeli government, may be the better path.
And the president did make that clear in the interview that he declined to say whether or not the United States would continue to block Palestinian efforts to secure statehood through the United Nations. He also said in his phone conversation with Prime Minister Netanyahu that he chastised Netanyahu for his rhetoric vis-a-vis Arabs coming out in droves, saying that this was not in the best tradition of Israeli politics. And to many people's mind, that has always been one of Israel's strengths, that it is a democracy in an area that has some pretty dreadful governments. Do you think that Netanyahu squandered one of Israel's best assets?
I think he's squandering it in many ways. I mean, I think that the Israeli democracy is the key to legitimizing Israel's existence. Israel has to show the world that a Jewish state can also be a democracy, and it's blessed in that effort by the fact that its founders did create a democratic system, even for those Arab Israelis who live within the Green Line. But Netanyahu is endangering that in several ways. First of all, of course, by entrenching Israeli control of the West Bank, where millions of Palestinians lack democratic rights. And then also here by kind of demonizing Israel's own Arab citizens, Palestinian citizens, really, who do have the right to vote. I mean, it would be a disaster for Israel if those Palestinian citizens of Israel, who they call Arab Israelis, were to start boycotting the elections en masse because they feel that fundamentally the system is fundamentally illegitimate. And yet, I think by demonizing them, you know, you're pushing them in exactly that direction.
And again, I'm speaking with Peter Barnard, who's a professor of journalism and political science at the City University of New York and a senior fellow at the New American Foundation. He's also a senior columnist for Haaretz and author of The Good Fight, The Icarus Syndrome, A History of American Hubris. And his latest book is The Crisis of Zionism. And he's at the J Street Conference in Washington, D.C. And J Street is an alternative or a liberal alternative to AIPAC. And what's your sense then of whether or not there is an apparent strategy of the Republicans in collusion with Netanyahu to defund the Democrats by driving a wedge between donors and the Democratic base that could put Hillary Clinton in a bind as she tries to win over the Democratic base that is increasingly disillusioned with Israel at the expense of alienating big donors who make support for Israel a top priority?
I don't think it's quite as you suggested. I mean, I do think that there is certainly a strategy on the part of Republicans to try to use the Israel issue to mobilize their voters. A lot of Christian conservatives are very, very kind of hawkish on the Israel subject. Also, to maintain the support of Jewish donors. There are some important Jewish donors in the Republican Party, like Sheldon Adelson. Perhaps even to win over some Jewish voters, although the history of this shows that it's actually not very easy to win over many Jewish voters on this question. And I think Netanyahu is to some degree, and Ron Dermer, complicit in that effort. But I don't think this really represents a threat to the funding base for Hillary Clinton. You know, Hillary Clinton has a vast funding network, including many, many, many Jews, most of whom are not right-wing on Israel or do not prioritize being right-wing on Israel in the way they relate to American politics. So I think that there are not very many of Hillary Clinton donors, I think, who are going to be so impressed by Benjamin Netanyahu and so unhappy with what Barack Obama is doing that they're going to turn away from Hillary Clinton, especially because Hillary Clinton herself is probably a little bit less adversarial when it comes to Benjamin Netanyahu than is Barack Obama.
But what do you think then, Speaker Boehner's visit to Israel to meet with Prime Minister Netanyahu at the end of the month, what's it about?
Well, I think there is a strong ideological affinity between the Republican Party and Benjamin Netanyahu. I mean, he is a very effective spokesperson for the way they view the world. They view the world as essentially a great clash between the West and the Islamic world, they believe that the way to manage that clash is through unrelenting pressure and supreme self-confidence, never admitting any mistakes or errors on our part, and Netanyahu is an articulate spokesman for what they genuinely believe. I think there's a lot of ideological congruence there. The Republican Party, there is a Jewish wing of the Republican Party and a Christian evangelical wing of the Republican Party, both of whom are important to the Republican Party in various ways, who sees Netanyahu as kind of the leader that they wish America's president would be. So Boehner has ample reasons to continue to stay on good terms with Benjamin Netanyahu.
But at the speech that Prime Minister Netanyahu made to the Congress, Sheldon Adelson was heavily featured there, and one didn't quite know whether the Republicans springing to their feet so often was because of Prime Minister Netanyahu's rhetoric and ability to wow the crowd and the extent to which there's this megabucks donor there. I mean, we have a money-driven political system, undoubtedly, and J Street, from my understanding, doesn't really hold a candle to AIPAC in regards to how much money AIPAC is able to dispense on Capitol Hill. So, and it seems like Sheldon Adelson is his own AIPAC. He apparently had a conversation recently with one of Hillary Clinton's biggest donors, who suggested that they could together they should buy the New York Times and the LA Times because they weren't
right. But I mean, in some ways, that if you're talking about Sam Saban, you know, right. That in some ways, Sam Saban is, I think, a good illustration. There's no chance Sam Saban can desert Hillary Clinton. He's hawkish on Israel, but he's a Democrat. He's very firmly ensconced in the Democratic Party, as are most non-Orthodox American Jews. I mean, yeah, I think the Republican support for Benjamin Netanyahu on Iran or vis-a-vis the Palestinians is both a function of the fact that there are Sheldon Adelsons out there who give them money and other, you know, wealthy American Jews in the Republican Party. But it's also a function of an actual, as I said, a real ideological affinity between the way the way they see the world and the way that Benjamin Netanyahu sees the world. There's, you know, even if you go back to Benjamin Netanyahu's view of the Cold War, at the very, very early beginning of the Cold War, he was, you know, a great admirer of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. So these are, you think you're walking through an open door because it's not like you have financing, which is forcing people to run, to override their own instincts. These are their instincts, and it also turns out that they can raise money based on them.
So in terms of your book, The Crisis of Zionism, I know you explored this issue, but recently I was visiting with an old friend of mine who's a Holocaust survivor, and he's 90 years old now, so I try to see him as often as I can. I'm not going to be around too much longer, but we were having coffee down at the beach in Venice, California, and a friend of his dropped by who said he'd voted for, he was a doctor or a dentist or something, he'd voted for Obama, and we got into a conversation, and he said, I hate the guy. He said, he's terrible on Israel, and frankly, Israel is my number one political concern. So where does that come from? Why do Americans feel, or some Americans, I should say, feel so passionate about Israel as a number one political concern?
Well, it's not. I mean, the polling shows pretty clearly that it's not actually the number one political concern for most American Jews. That it's actually fairly far down the list after a whole series of domestic concerns, which are not so different than the domestic concerns of other Americans, you know, healthcare, the economy. Abortion is a very, very strong driver of the Jewish vote. American Jews tend to be a bit more pro-choice and more pro-gay rights than almost any other demographic. There is a group of American Jews who tend to be older and tend to be more religious, who are more likely to be single-issue Israel voters or prioritize the Israel issue, and they also tend to be further to the right on Israel. Why is that? I mean, one could talk for a long time about this. I mean, older American Jews are more likely to have experienced the fragility of Jewish life in the 20th century, whether with memories of the Holocaust or the 1967 war, personal experiences of anti-Semitism. And so for them, the existence of a Jewish state and the idea that a Jewish state is in constant peril is something that flows from their life experience. Orthodox Jews who are now mostly Republican kind of grow up in a milieu in which Israel and Zionism are constant and very important presences in their lives. I mean, my own children, for instance, go to a Jewish school, and the clock when you walk into the school gives you the time in Jerusalem. It's a very Zionism infused environment, and so that tends to shape the way that more religious Jews see the world and see Israeli politics. But it's important to recognize that this is a minority of American Jews, and that's why Barack Obama overwhelmingly won the Jewish vote both times. It's why American Jews have voted Democratic for president since before Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, just in closing, Peter Beinart, how is Hillary Clinton going to navigate the fact that, one, she's got to win over the Democratic base? There's not a lot of enthusiasm, at least on the political left in this country. And people keep talking about Elizabeth Warren, which is not going to happen, but it shows you that they're casting around for an alternative. The African Americans and Latinos and the young, apparently, according to recent polls, are getting increasingly disillusioned with Israel. So how does she navigate between the Haim Sabans and the Democratic left?
I'm not sure it's going to be that difficult. It's true that African Americans and Latinos and the young are more critical of Israel, but they don't prioritize that in their voting. not going to be one of the top five voting issues in terms of them making a decision for president. And besides, where do they have to go anyway? I mean, as you say, she's going to have virtually no primary opposition, and then she's going to be facing a Republican candidate who's far to their right. So they're not going to express their displeasure with Israeli policy by voting for, you know, Ted Cruz or Jeb Bush or Scott Walker or Marco Rubio. I don't think it's going to be that difficult for her, frankly. I think that what she will do is maneuver a little bit to the right of where Barack Obama is, but still significantly to the left of where the Republican candidate is. And I think that will be fine for her Democratic donors, and I think it'll be fine for most Democratic voters.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Peter Barnett.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Peter Barnett, who's a professor of journalism and political science at the City University of New York and a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. He's also a senior columnist for Haaretz and author of The Good Fight, The Icarus Syndrome, A History of American Hubris, and his latest book is The Crisis of Zionism. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and talk about the what appears to be an erupting civil war in Yemen. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Sheila Karapika, who's a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond, where she researches the political economy of development with special emphasis on Arab countries. Recently, she was a visiting professor in the political science department at the American University of Cairo, and she's the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia. And her latest book is Political Aid and Arab Activism, Democracy Promotion, Justice and Representation. She's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Sheila Karapika.
Nice to speak with you, Ian.
And the fact that the Houthis have now taken this third largest city in Yemen, and, you know, they came from the north and they took over an awful lot of territory, and they seem to be taking over more and more territory. So what's going on? I mean, are they unstoppable?
You know, in my view, at least as of today, I mean, Taiz is a real overreach, I think, for them. It's the city where they're least likely to have more than a modicum of popular support. There are huge demonstrations against them and their advance into the city. So and this, I mean, if they had asked me, I would have advised them to stay out of Taiz.
So do you think that there will be a reversal? I mean, who on the other side with this ousted government, because one of the things I understand that helped them, the Houthis, in taking over Taiz was the duplicity of the former deposed leader of Yemen, Saleh.
Well, that certainly seems to be the case. And, I mean, so far in, you know, the various stages of this Houthi advance, the conventional forces have just not tried to resist. And so, you know, they walked into Sana'a, they reached Taiz without much armed resistance.
So we were asking you about the role of the ousted President Saleh, the previously ousted President Saleh, in apparently supporting the Houthi takeover behind the scenes of the third largest city, Taiz.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, he does seem to be meddling actively. And, of course, we've also heard recently some, I think, fairly preposterous sums, like $60 billion that he pilfered out of national coffers. So, and then we've also heard about the supposed U.S. lost track of some pretty heavy weaponry. So it appears that Saleh is using his access to those weapons and those funds to pay people to fight on his behalf. And he seems, I mean, I would consider it probably a tactical or short-term alliance with the Houthis, because Saleh is known for that sort of thing, you know, forming short-term marriages of convenience or whatever you want to call it. But he's clearly trying to disrupt the transition. I think he feels that he's been double-crossed by both the Saudis and Hadi, of course, was his vice president, and he basically, you know, in a certain way, appointed him. So he's one of the several wild cards in this mess.
But he was the U.S.'s champion, the U.S.'s focus, of course, on al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And incidentally, it was the so-called Islamic State who claimed authorship over this suicide bombing of the Shady Shiite mosques that killed 130 people. But given that our focus has been on AQIP, as it's called, do you think that, I mean, clearly, if this guy stole $60 billion from one of the poorest countries in the world, somebody in the United States government should have noticed that?
You would think, and also the World Bank and Saudi Arabia. I mean, $60 billion may be high, but, you know, even if it's only, let's say, I don't know, half that, that's still a lot of money. The United States, I think, has not done its due diligence in Yemen for quite some time. I think it's clear that we mostly take our intelligence and, indeed, sort of our orders from Saudi Arabia, which has very strange and complicated objectives and mixed motives in Yemen. And the U.S. has just been focusing on so-called AQAP, al-Qaeda in the peninsula. You know, in terms of the Islamic State claiming responsibility, I think there's probably a little bit more to be learned about that, because it may be the case that it's a group that decided to identify itself with the Daesh or the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, rather than those people there at, shall we say, ISIL Central, if there is such a thing, claiming responsibility. So this is one of very many murky and, I think, constantly shifting factors, which makes it so confusing and, frankly, so potentially deadly.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sheila Karapiko, who's a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond, where she researches the political economy and development of, with special emphasis on Arab countries. Recently, she was a visiting professor in the political science department at the American University of Cairo and is the author of Civil Society in Yemen, the Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia. And her latest book is Political Aid and Arab Activism, Democracy Promotion, Justice and Representation. And she's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. But it would seem, Sheila, with this these negotiations with the Iranians and the P5 plus one getting close to resolution, that's at least that's the rumors we hear, you can't help sort of noticing that the even though the Shiites are, what, 10% of the Islamic world, they seem to be doing pretty well against the majority Sunnis. You've got the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards essentially running the ground war in Iraq as they're retaking Tikrit, and then they're poised to retake Mosul. And the feeling is that the U.S. is sort of trying to figure out a new way to re-engage the Assad regime. Perhaps the Iranians behind the scenes will help them ease Assad out, but the long and the short of it is it looks like we're going to be squeezing the Islamic State from one side with the Iranians and the other side with Hezbollah. And then you've got on top of that the success of the Houthis taking over most of Yemen, essentially, you know, in Saudi Arabia's backyard, even though I think ties between Iran and the Houthis are often exaggerated, it's still there's still a real connection there. So do you see the region sort of things breaking Iran's way in the region?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think you're right that compared with Iraq, for example, the Iranians are, I mean, although they're clearly involved on the behalf of the Houthis, but I doubt if they're calling the shots. And it still does seem that probably it's the radical Salafis, who like to call themselves Sunnis, who are interested in provoking a sectarian war. I mean, that's, I think, how we need to understand the bombing of two mosques in Sana'a, where practically all mosques in Sana'a are basically Zaydi. You know, to the extent to which Iran would actually benefit from this much chaos, to me, it's hard to be certain that they see it that way. I mean, a rivalry with Saudi Arabia, absolutely, and that's, of course, true on the other side as well. But, I mean, I think one of the scary things in Yemen, and perhaps elsewhere, but I'll just keep my remarks to Yemen, is that it's difficult to see who are the rational actors, you know, who have any real strategic purpose. I mean, Saleh seems to be fighting a losing game or a loser's game. The Houthis seem to be overstretching. The Saudis make, to my mind, bad calls. The U.S. is now pulling out. The World Bank, you know, kind of started this whole mess by demanding that the Hadi government lift fuel subsidies last summer, as if that would be a good idea amidst a collapsing economy and political situation. I don't know if, I mean, to go back to your question, I don't know if Iran is really benefiting or is in any meaningful way calling the shots.
So what you're suggesting, Sheila Karapiga, is that the Saudis and the U.S. and this crooked former leader and his appointed VP, they're the ones that are screwing up, and that all that the Sunni can do, at least all they're doing now, is these provocative attacks on mosques, which you're very familiar with, going back to what happened in Iraq and is still happening in Iraq. So is that where we're heading? Just more sort of bloodshed and destabilization, but no sign of stability or some kind of way to, or perhaps split the country between the North and the South as it used to be?
I mean, I'm more pessimistic today than I have ever been. The Southerners have been, of course, you know, advocating for re-separation for quite some time, and then Hadi basically got chased out of Sana'a and has, you know, tried to reestablish his government in Aden, which makes the split, if it occurs, it's on a different dimension than what we would have seen, you know, a month or two ago, or certainly before then, because, you know, it's basically what was until recently the northern-based government has now reestablished itself in the south, and the south doesn't, I don't think that the majority of the southern movement called the Herak, you know, welcome Hadi, even though he's a native southerner, or the rest of the what used to be the Sana'a-based government in the south. So there also there seems to be a kind of new set of fault lines. And then the first part of your question, I think, is, you know, yeah, I think that, I mean, this incident in the mosques in Sana'a, I mean, you know, that only takes a very small number of people to do something like that. But the repercussions are almost unfathomable.
So when you say that the U.S. is pulling out, I know they pulled out their diplomatic presence, but they still have a drone presence, and they operate out of Djibouti, just across from South Yemen. So, I mean, they're not pulling out in that sense, are they, militarily? I mean, they still seem to think...
Latest reports are that 100 or 150 American military, I'm not sure which branch, who were near the place called Houta in Lahej province, and Al-Qaeda took over a town very close to the American base. And the latest reports are that the American soldiers, or, again, Air Force, I'm not quite sure, that it's not consistent, but anyway, American military forces have evacuated that base. I mean, that's kind of dramatic, even more so in a sense than pulling out all the diplomats, which has also happened. So, yeah, there's still a drone program that can be based in Djibouti and also in, from a base in Saudi Arabia. And I suppose they can continue to go after al-Qaeda, but I don't understand why that would be considered to be a really useful thing. I mean, I guess it is. If they're driving American troops out of the base, then I guess we might expect that the Americans try to counterattack.
Well, Sheila Carapico, I thank you for joining us.
Yeah, hopefully better. We'll have less... grim conversation next time.
No, I'm sorry. That seems to be the pattern here. And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sheila Carapico, who's a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond, where she researches the political economy of development with special emphasis on Arab countries. Recently, she was a visiting professor in the political science department at the American University of Cairo and is the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia. Her latest book is Political Aid in Arab Activism, Democracy Promotion, Justice and Representation. And she's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with an Israeli activist who is regularly shot at by his own army with rubber bullets and tear gas.
كل صانع كل باني ومهندس قال يسقط النظام
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ronny Bakan, who is an Israeli activist, a conscientious objector, and co-founder of Boycott From Within, a group of conscientious Israelis who support the Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. Previously, he represented the Popular Struggle Coordination Committees at the European Parliament in Brussels, where he challenged EU institutional complicity in Israeli violations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ronny Bakan.
Hi, Ian.
And you are, I guess, a representative of the Israeli left, and you're somebody that puts yourself on the front line in protests. You've been shot at with rubber bullets and tear gas as you've protested with Palestinians against confiscation of their land and the occupation. So let me ask you, how do you feel about what just happened in Israel, the surprise victory of Prime Minister Netanyahu?
Yes, actually, when there was the exit polls just after the elections, the polls said that the situation was that there was somewhat of a tie between the right wing and the so-called left in Israel. I say so-called left because it is not about left. It is they don't have a left-wing agenda. It is just they only speak a different language. But that was a little surprising because we all know that Israeli society and also the Israeli government is definitely taking a right-wing approach. And then when I woke up the next day, the final polls were much more, actually made much more sense, and we did see that Netanyahu basically won by a landslide. So I think that this is in itself is not surprising, the fact that Netanyahu geared his voters and he received points simply by being even more hawkish than he usually would be, by stating clearly that there will be no Palestinian state, by threatening his voters that the Arab voters are amassing and basically going to the polls in their masses, and that was enough to basically for him to win the elections, just by saying if you will not elect me, then you will get someone who will demand or will promote something that will promote Palestinian rights to a certain degree.
So, but in effect, the Israeli people have voted, at least a majority. So that, does this indicate to you that the attitudes of the Israeli people, the majority of the Israeli people, are those of Netanyahu's, that even though he's talked about a peace deal, he's basically said it would never happen on my watch? And apparently, in an interview that President Obama just did with the Huffington Post, Obama is sort of more or less going to hold him to that, to his own words. You know, yes. He's taking him at his word, if you will, until he proves otherwise. Also, in a phone call to Netanyahu, Obama did, quoting Obama, we indicated that the kind of rhetoric which you're talking about, this anti-Arab coming to the polls mm-hmm. in droves, was contrary to what is the best of Israeli traditions, that Israel was founded based on the historic Jewish homeland and the need for to have a Jewish homeland, but Israeli democracy has been premised on everybody in the country being treated equally and fairly. And frankly, that, to my mind, that is has always been Israel's greatest strength, particularly compared to the governments in the neighborhood that are just appalling. Do you think that Netanyahu has squandered one of Israel's best assets?
So I would like to address some of the points that you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. First of all, Netanyahu, the notion that there is an Israeli left-wing camp or that there is a peace camp in Israel is simply not true. So we know that during the recent attack on Gaza, the recent massacre that took place last summer, 95% of Israeli Jews supported the attack. Actually, many of them said that that Netanyahu was not using enough force against the Hamas. We have to remember that 2,000 people have been killed there, 500 of which were children. About over 70% were civilians. Just the same numbers, 95% of Israeli public, when we say Israeli, this is an exclusive society. So when I say Israeli, I mean Israeli Jews, 80% of the population. 95% of them supported the massacre of 2008, 2009. And also after the fact, a few months after the fact, when they learned about the atrocities that took place there, still over 80% of them supported it in retrospect. So to claim that there is some sort of a left wing in Israel is simply not true. Actually, the left wing, the so-called left wing campaign, election campaign, was about portraying Netanyahu as being weak and actually saying that we, Livni and Herzog, we would have used more force towards Gaza. We would have done a better job. This was part of their election campaign. So basically, Israeli society was built in a very with a very militaristic notion, even built on fascist type of thinking that promotes militarism, promotes the use of force. And this is what we see, and we definitely see this in the recent election campaign and in the results. The notion that Israel was built as some sort of a democracy is simply not true. Actually, Israel was built on the basis of everything that's opposed to democratic values, everything that's opposed to equality, everything that is opposed to the rights of minorities, and so on. It claims to be Jewish and democratic, but in effect, it is both anti-Jewish and anti-democratic. It is Zionism is a nationalist movement that only uses Judaism to gain legitimacy for its illegitimate practices. But Zionism was a secular movement that had nothing to do with Judaism. And we can go, I can give you many examples about that. But we have to remember that the only reason that Netanyahu insists over and over about that Abbas and others have to recognize Israel as a Jewish state is not because of religious elements, but because Israel is Jewish just like South Africa was white at the time. It is Jewish by its ethnic supremacist character. And this is not a legitimate thing. We should not, I do not recognize Israel, Israel's right to be an ethnic supremacist state. I insist that it will transform into a legitimate entity. It will transform and it will abide by those values that we cherish, those democratic values that we are trying to promote. And that mainly means that we need to have equality for all the people of that land, not only for the privileged group that I belong to.
Well, just I know I asked you a whole bunch of questions there, Ronnie, but if you could just address what Obama said in his interview with the Huffington Post, that he's going to hold Netanyahu to his original election promise that the Palestinian state would never happen on his watch. And also, President Obama refused to say whether or not he would block Palestinian efforts to secure statehood through the United Nations.
Yes. We know that the whole two-state discourse is being used a lot as a form of perpetuating pretty much of the same. And this discourse allows, actually, for Israel to carry on doing whatever it does. But for one reason or another, for the U.S. administration, it is very important to maintain that type of discourse. And Netanyahu, for his reasons, does not speak the same language. Basically, the right wing, the more right wing, the more hawkish parliamentarians in Israel, they will not accept any form of two-state solution. They demand that that land is ours and only ours. And by that, actually, Netanyahu received more votes by saying that there will be no Palestinian state. Now, these responses coming from Obama, I think that is extremely important. This is a clear sign that things are changing. We know that things are changing. The whole discourse about Israel is changing for the past decade or so. 10 years ago, people would still discuss Israel as the only democracy in the Middle East, even though it's not a democracy and never was one, not even to begin with, as I mentioned before. But nowadays, all over the world, as we speak, there are hundreds of campuses around the world that hold Israel Apartheid Week activities, week-long activities concerning the issue of Israeli apartheid and what can be done about that. But we also know that the administration, even in the U.S., behind closed doors, John Kerry behind closed doors, he questions whether Israel is an apartheid state. And I think that this is something that should be addressed seriously. What is the nature of the state of Israel and what can be done in order to have equal rights for all the people of that land? And by Obama taking this different position towards Netanyahu, that is a sign of change that actually brings with it quite a lot of optimism about the future, that actually Israel may be held accountable for its actions and it may be possible to change its ways.
Again, I'm speaking with Ronnie Barkan, who is an Israeli activist, a conscientious objector, and co-founder of Boycott From Within, a group of conscientious Israelis who support the Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. Previously, he represented the Popular Struggle Coordination Committees at the European Parliament in Brussels, where he challenged EU institutional complicity in Israeli violations. But I think, though, and you've made the point about Israeli democracy, Ronnie, but it would seem to me that still, compared to the other governments in the region, the Israelis aren't that bad. I mean, you're talking about murderous regimes in Syria, the Islamic State, and you've got these corrupt monarchs, particularly the Saudis, who've spread this toxic version of Islam around the world. But my understanding is that one of the problems that the Israelis have, or at least what they continually refer to, is that when they gave up Gaza, they got nothing in return except rockets being fired at them, and that they just, that to them is the litmus test for a Palestinian state. And they made a concession and it didn't work, and they're not about to make another concession. Is that your understanding of the prevailing mentality?
So, first of all, we have to remember that it is true that there are other countries in the world that are possibly worse than Israel, but none of them claim to be democratic or gain so much, have so much legitimacy around the world. None of them have the absolute support of the U.S., both militarily, financially, diplomatically. The U.S. even vetoes U.N. resolutions that go against its own. The U.S. states one thing, its stated foreign policy is one thing, and then it vetoes and goes against its own stated foreign policy only in order to protect Israel. Unfortunately, Israel also has full impunity also coming from the EU. And the EU is legally obligated to act in a certain way. For example, its trade agreement with Israel legally obligates the EU not to carry on with business as usual with Israel because of Israel's consistent human rights violations. However, every member state of the EU chooses to look the other way whenever it comes to Israel and violate its own, not only international law, violate also its own European law and the agreement that it is signed upon in order to protect Israel. So Israel is a special case in that sense, not in the sense that it is the most dangerous or despotic regime in the Middle around the world, but because it has full impunity. And what we demand is that Israel will be treated, that Israel will not be above the law, and it will be treated just like any other state, no more, no less. That will bring about a huge difference in the way that Israel acts. Now, specifically about Gaza, Gaza has not been liberated. What is happening is that Israel still controls Gaza in every possible way, from the air, the sea, the land. The only thing that changed is that Israel actually pulled out of Gaza and it controls it through its perimeter. At the same time, every once in a while, it bombs Gaza, and those people who are being bombed there, they literally have nowhere safe to go to. At the same time, 95% of the water in Gaza is toxic. It is not fit for human consumption. This is something that is directly related to Israeli control of Gaza. Now, this is a humanitarian crisis, but it is a politically motivated crisis. People actually sat in an office and decided that this should be the case in Gaza. Another example is that Israel, and we know this because actually the Ministry of Defense, the Israeli Ministry of Defense, had to submit these papers to the Israeli court. Israel has actually formulated formulas counting the caloric intake for people in Gaza. And they even went as far as making amendments to these formulas, saying, well, you know, the people in Gaza, they don't need so much fresh fruit and vegetables. They need more white flour and sugar and oil. This is all in the formulas. Now, Israel claims that they haven't implemented these formulas, but just going as far as that should really raise so many questions about the type of control that Israel is implementing there in Gaza, where they go as far as calculating the caloric intake of the people there, the 1.8 million civilians who live there. I do not accept that Israel does not control Gaza. It absolutely controls Gaza in every possible way. Even the Gaza, even the Sea of Gaza, where fishermen cannot go to fish. And if they go beyond a certain perimeter, even though this is not what has been agreed upon, then they can be shot by, Israeli vessels there.
Well, let's talk then about, you mentioned the European Union looking the other way. But while the European Union may be duplicitous in the way that you described, the European public seem to be turning further and further away from Israel, and that's been going on for some decades. And the assumption is that eventually that will happen here in the United States, that people, particularly the minorities in this country, African Americans, Latinos, and the young, apparently increasingly disenchanted with Israel. So you have the situation where America gives Israel unconditional political support, but the reality is that most of its trade is with Europe. So that is obviously where Israel is vulnerable in terms of its economy. And tell me about what you're trying to do in terms of divestment. And is this an attempt to force Israel to change its policies because of economic pressure from Europe?
Yes. The BDS campaign, it is a Palestinian-led campaign that started in July 2005, about 10 years ago. What we call for is that Israel will abide by its obligations under international law and human rights conventions that it has signed upon, and more specifically, that it respects three fundamental rights of the Palestinians, which are the ending of the brutal military occupation of the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem, equality inside Israel, and most importantly, the right of the refugees, those who, the indigenous people of the land who have been expelled from there since the foundation of the state of Israel in order to create and artificially create a Jewish majority there by driving away the indigenous population from their land. These are the three fundamental rights of the Palestinians. And until such a time that Israel abides by its obligations, we are calling on the international community to apply nonviolent means of pressure, of boycott, divestment, sanctions. And this has been, this is proving to be extremely successful so far in the past 10 years. Now, obviously, boycott is something that every one of us can do and should do in order to hold Israel accountable. And there are many forms of boycott, including cultural and academic and sports and so on. Then divestment is something that if one is invested in a certain company or students or their university is invested in certain companies, also it could be American companies that are acting in complicity with Israel and allowing for Israeli violations, then we're asking them to pull out their investments and invest in a socially responsible way. And finally, there's sanctions. Now, sanctions is something that an international body can do, like the UN and so on. If there would have been sanctions, and as I mentioned with the EU-Israel trade agreements, there should be sanctions under that agreement, okay? If there would be sanctions, then we wouldn't have to do our share because the situation would not be able to carry on. The consistent, systematic human rights violations of Palestinians will not be able to carry on, and Israel would have to change its ways. But since these international bodies are not doing what they're obligated to do, then it is up to us, to the public, to speak up, and there is a public outcry by now, both in Europe, and I'm happy to say that also in the U.S., where people are speaking up and saying enough is enough, and we will not take it any longer. We insist on holding Israel accountable. So we hear every day about different, even here in the U.S., we hear about different divestment campaigns coming from universities. Most recently in California, there have been quite a few campuses that have chosen to divest from Israel. We hear even about American Jewry and Jewish population here in the U.S. That are slowly, gradually distancing themselves from Israel, even though they grew up to be Zionists and blindly supporting the state of Israel. They see that what is happening now, possibly thanks to Netanyahu and his rhetoric, they see that it is indefensible, and they cannot carry on holding that position that they used to have, and they are gradually distancing themselves from Israel. And I'm happy to say that Jewish Voice for Peace, which is an organization that grew dramatically during the past years, has recently, most recently in its convention, took a clear stand in support of the BDS campaign. That is extremely important as well. And we hear more and more, and definitely, as you mentioned, there have been even voices coming from the Afro-American communities and others in support of Palestine, and also vice versa. And this is extremely important. And so we hear that there is definitely a public outcry also here in the U.S., which demands to hold Israel accountable and demands the basic rights of the Palestinians. And this is all we demand.
Sure. Well, look, we're running out of time, so let me two quick questions I wanted to ask you. One is that you work with the Jewish Orthodox community, which struggles against Zionism. And I was in Washington at the time Netanyahu gave his speech to the Congress, and I noticed this huge demonstration of ultra-Orthodox holding up signs saying, Netanyahu, go home. You don't speak for the Jewish people. What motivates the ultra-Orthodox, just in the last minute?
Yes, we have to remember that as we speak, there is a very serious struggle between the Jewish ultra-Orthodox community and the State of Israel, even those who live inside Israel, and also, obviously, those who live here in the U.S. About a year ago, the State of Israel decided to conscript those ultra-Orthodox men into the army, even though that goes against their tradition, their centuries-long tradition of studying the Bible and not participating in anything nationalistic, definitely not participating in the army. And they see what is happening now, where Israel is forcing them into the army, and by them refusing to do so, to be that they will end up in a military jail. They see this as a holy war, nothing less than a holy war between them and the State of Israel, them and between them and Zionism. And this is what we hear. And actually, as we speak, there are demonstrations taking place in Israel between the ultra-Orthodox and the State of Israel, and the Israeli authorities around that. And this is something that I urge people to follow because it is not so much available in the mainstream media. The ultra-Orthodox, you need to look for that information that otherwise will not reach mainstream media, and I'm trying to help that information to become more available. And this is a very important struggle that is happening inside Israel. And the ultra-Orthodox, they are the largest growing demographics in Israel, but they are not, most of them are not Zionist. And therefore, Israel is trying to conscript them into the army in order to sort of Zionize them, to take them, bring them away from Judaism and make them more nationalistic and less Jewish.
Well, just in closing, how do you face all of these rubber bullets and tear gas as you demonstrate with Palestinians against the occupation and against the settlers?
I have to tell you that these rubber-coated bullets and the tear gas canisters are actually made in the U.S., and they are being used for oppression and repression all over the world, definitely by Israel. And actually, in these nonviolent demonstrations that are being held every week in the West Bank, Israel is trying out all these different means of what's called less than lethal weapons, which are sometimes lethal. Some people have actually died during these demonstrations. So what we do is we just carry on, and obviously that is we are being beaten and we are being arrested for doing that, but if the Palestinians who are demonstrating, they carry on and they are willing to stand for their rights, even in light of even though they stand to suffer the consequences of brutal repression by Israel, then I am happy to join them in their struggle, in their just struggle.
I thank you so much for joining us here today, Rani Bakan.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Rani Bakan, who's an Israeli activist, a conscientious objector, and co-founder of Boycott From Within, a group of conscientious Israelis who support the Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. Previously, he represented the Popular Struggle Coordination Committees of the European Parliament in Brussels, where he challenged EU institutional complicity in Israel's violations. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.